part by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Registration is not required and individuals can join at any time. For more information, call 384-5829 or www.livingyogacenter.net. Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois.
Thanks to the friends of WILL, whose contributions have helped us maintain a strong program schedule in 2004. Your gifts support almost half our annual operating budget. If you appreciate the programs but haven't yet contributed, consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift. Write a check to the Friends of WILL Radio and mail it to the University of Illinois Foundation, Box 3429, Champaign, 61826. Thank you, and happy holidays.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Freinas at the controls. Tomorrow morning, just let me make a quick mention of the topics. In the first hour, we will talk about the past, present, future of the United States Supreme Court. Our guest will be David Garrow. He's Presidential Distinguished Professor of Law, currently on leave from Emory University. Then in the second hour, the guest, Robert McCrum. He's the literary editor of The Observer, and we will talk with him about a new biography that he's written about the British humorist P.G. Wodehouse. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. This morning, in this hour of the show, we will talk about a beverage that, in the estimation of our guest, may be one of history's most influential drinks, and that is rum. Our guest is Charles Coulomb, and he is the author of a recently published book, which is entitled Rum, the Epic Story of the Drink That Conquered the World. Citadel Press is the publisher. It's out there now in the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at it. It's interesting history, and it even contains some recipes for things that you might do with rum. So your questions and comments are certainly welcome as we talk in this part of the show with our guest, Charles Coulomb. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455, anywhere that you can hear us. Mr. Coulomb, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Well, I've been better, I've been worse.
Well, we could all say that about ourselves. We appreciate you talking with us today. We thank you very much for your time.
Well, certainly it's a pleasure.
I think one of the things that we know is that human beings discovered fermentation a long time ago, and various places, various cultures around the world have used what they had at hand, and they produced spirituous alcoholic beverages. So that's not exactly new, and depending, again, on what you have, that's kind of your thing, and people may well indeed have strong feelings about whatever it is there, if they have a national beverage, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm interested in having you for a moment is defend the subtitle and talk about the fact that is indeed rum somehow in its significance and its spread more potent, so to speak, than other alcoholic beverages?
Absolutely. Because of its, I don't want to steal my thunder from later, but basically, the thing with rum was that it lasted longer than anything else. I mean, lasted with its taste intact. It was stronger than most local brews. I mean, banana beer just didn't compete. It's true. Mm. Experts agree. And the proof of the pudding is that wherever the Europeans took rum, it pretty much crowded all the local stuff out of the market. In Europe, It caught on. It didn't get rid of wine and beer and whiskey and so forth. But it nevertheless became very popular. And even today is more popular on the continent than we think about. You've heard of rum baba, I suppose.
Yes.
Well, that's one of the remnants of the rum craze of the 17th and 18th centuries in continental Europe. And what amazed me in my research, I mean, I'd always thought of the seafaring nations as being big rum drinkers for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize until I began the research for this thing what an impact it had in Central Europe as well. But at any rate, the biggest key to rum's usefulness, to rum's power, was the fact that it was simply the best thing to take on shipboard.
Just because it traveled well.
That's it.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, the taste helped, of course. All that other stuff was very true. But its ability to keep that taste forever and not to spoil over long sea voyages, those are the two things.
Well,
the
that's
the travelability.
That sort of jumps ahead in the story a little bit, but I guess it's as good a time as any to comment on the association that I'm sure people will have in their minds between the sea, or at least between sailors and rum, and that's it. And of course, people who have read sea stories, if you've read Patrick O'Brien or read about Horatio Hornblower or anything like that, you'll know that there was a very long tradition in the British Navy, but not just in the British Navy, about the sailors getting, when they were on the ships, having a daily ration of rum. And I was really surprised, in fact, to learn in the book that in the British Navy, that continued until 1970. In Canada, it continued until, I think, 1972. And I think, if I remember right, in the Indian Navy to this day, sailors still get a daily ration of rum.
That's right. And believe it or not, amongst sailors is a very emotional issue. And I can't say that the performance of any of those navies have improved since dropping it, nor can I say that the Indian Navy has suffered thereby. But, you know, not being in charge, I don't make those decisions.
Well, apparently it was in Britain when they started to have a public debate about the idea of stopping the naval rum ration. It apparently was quite controversial, and there was an enormous amount of debate about it.
It sure was. But, of course, as you know, whenever a British government is in charge and has a majority in Parliament, they have carte blanche to do anything they want in the end. And that's what happened here. There are still some very sore heads about it all these years later. But to be fair, if you were going to get rid of it, they probably did it in the best way they could, which was to transmute it into other things, amongst them a charity for the dependents and so on of sailors. And, of course, because they gave it up and because they sold the recipe to Pusser's Rum, you can have exactly the same experience yourself in the quiet of your own home.
That's interesting that you also write about the fact that for a long time there was a producer that was the exclusive purveyor of rum to the British Navy, and they had a particular formula, a way of doing it, and that sailors got used to what it tasted like, and they were not satisfied often with the product that they would get in the taverns when they were on shore.
Absolutely. And, of course, as you may recall, this was a particular problem during World War II when shall we say, the Royal Navy had other things to transport. And so they became very dependent in various areas on whatever local rums they could come up with. And a lot of the sailors were not terribly pleased with them. Of course, they did have other things to worry about as well, it being wartime and everything.
Well, when did the daily rum ration start in the British Navy? This was something that by the time that it was ended in 1970 had been around for literally for hundreds of years.
Yeah, well, it actually it got started way back in the beginning, actually, of Britain's expansion in the West Indies, and actually the very first person that we can look to in terms of an official rationing of rum was none other than Admiral William Penn, and he was an important person in our history because his son was the founder of Pennsylvania. But in 1655, at the orders of Oliver Cromwell, he attacked the Spanish island of Jamaica. And that, he was the first one to order the distribution of rum to the men.
And just as a way of trying to, knowing that they would drink anyway, and as a way of trying to control it, or was this as a reward?
Well, it was just as a regular thing. You've got to understand that the attitude of our ancestors to alcohol was a bit different to ours. Water was unreliable. Life was very, very hard. And alcohol was looked at both as medicine and as a relief from the pressures of every day, which, physically speaking, were very, very hard. So back to Roman days, I suppose, there had always been some sort of alcohol given out aboard ship, usually wine or beer. But these things didn't really travel well, especially across the Atlantic. Beer would go bad, and wine, the taste would be ruined. Water went bad. So when in the early 17th century, rum began being made in Barbados, and that's the prehistory of rum is kind of an interesting thing as well, but at any rate, the commercial shipping, I suppose you'd say, picked it up. And then Penn had the idea, since it was available and since it lasted, of using it for his men. And it was more potent than wine. It was more potent than beer.
Hmm.
And it kept. And it tasted very good. What's not to like?
Hmm.
And, of course, the Jamaican campaign was extremely difficult. The Spanish, you know, they never get the credit for the soldiers they were, but they were hard fighters. And on top of it, they released their slaves, who carried on a guerrilla warfare against the English for another 150, almost 200 years. The Maroons, they're called.
We have a caller here, and would like to bring him into the conversation and also, again, introduce our guest, Charles Colomb. He is the author of a book entitled Rum, The Epic Story of the Drink That Conquered the World, published by Citadel Press. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with the caller here in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You've already alluded to the comfort food factor that people want more of what they've gotten used to, or it's supposed to be a certain way once they make up their mind. And I'm sure that the popularity had something to do with novelty. We all always go for the latest craze, the newest thing. But as a background, what was the state of distillation and availability, I suppose, in Europe at about 1600? What sorts of things were being fermented and then distilled? Were there beverages that were fermented and drunk, or fermented and then you skip whatever the ferment is and go right to the distillation and the aging, which is what I'm sure makes it expensive? But I have no sense of when whiskeys became popular or were widely produced, when brandy wine was distilled from brandy, I'm sorry, from wines, and all that background that we take for granted now. What was the rum meeting when it hit Europe? I'll just hang up and listen if you can do a background for us.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure, that's an extremely good question. The to answer it, in addition to beer and wine, there were already spirits around. Throughout its history, man will ferment anything. The ancestors of our whiskeys were already being made in the Celtic fringe. Clear spirits, what we would call vodka and what they called aqua vitae, were made all over the place from potatoes, from various grains and so forth. It's interesting that all these hard spirits, whether you're speaking of Gaelic, the whiskabal from which we get whiskey, aquavit in Scandinavia and so forth, it all comes from aqua vitae, the Latin water of life. So this stuff was around, but it was very harsh. And it was not considered refined in those days in the 17th century, which is the period when rum makes its appearance. They began in, I suppose, the late 16th, but early, certainly in the early 17th, they began fortifying wines. And your sherries, your ports, your brandies and so forth begin emerging at this time. The 18th century, the wonderful Benedictine monk, Dom Perignon, discovers champagne. But rum did definitely come into a vacuum in Europe as well, there's no doubt about it, because our caller mentioned the novelty factor. Rum was not harsh like these other spirits. It was not identified with peasants getting plastered like these other spirits were. So it had both the social cachet, it had the novelty effect, it tasted really good, it was very smooth. And that, the psychological, how do I put it, not exactly snob appeal, but the affair of the feeling of sophistication that so often in its history rum has had was very much present at its entrance to Europe. Because remember, in those days, people looked at folks from the West Indies, the Nabobs, the West Indian planters, as men of wealth, men of distinction, who had gone out to the colonies, made a fortune, and come back. So the image of the West Indian planter was very big in the popular mind in Europe, and of course, rum came with that. So snob appeal as always. It's look at how much of our booze advertising today reflects snob appeal. I hope that answers it.
Indeed. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Apparently, rum, the drink with that name, originates in the West Indies, specifically in Barbados, and I guess 1650 in round numbers, that's the date that's given. Was it, in fact, produced before then, this alcoholic beverage, essentially, it's made from sugar cane, so it's a byproduct of making sugar. That's when we started calling it rum, but I don't imagine that it was invented at that point in Barbados.
The name was first given to it there. As to where the actual drink, the fermented distilled molasses, was started, that's really, really hard to conjecture. There were obviously fermented sugarcane juice drinks around, like today's cachaça from Brazil. But certainly the distilled molasses piece didn't come about too much earlier than the first naming of it in Barbados. It's very hard to say. And, of course, a lot of different places will claim the honor. But Barbados first named it. It didn't make its travel around the world much before that. And so this is the best we can come up with, right? Really.
There's a lot of conjecture apparently as to where the word comes from.
Oh yes, there are all kinds of possibilities, from the notion that it's an old West of English word, because originally it was called rumbustion or rumbullion, and there's conjecture that comes from an old Devonshire word for a fight, I suppose, because the first rums were not, shall we say, very alcohol-free. It often led to all kinds of hijinks. There are others claim, most notably the Encyclopedia Britannica in 1911, that it comes from a Malay word. But since they don't bother to tell us what the Malay word is, and I haven't been able to find any record of it, I don't know. It doesn't appear to be related, at least so the various authorities say, to rum as in strange. You know, the British English rum go and so forth. But, again, as with all these things, you'll find as many different opinions as there are authorities. Certainly, though, it was originally called rumbustion or rumbullion, or the other great name for it, kill devil.
That, again, would tell you something about its potency.
Yeah, it was not a light drink. It also tells you something about the people of that time. That, well, what can I say? They liked to drink that tasted great and would knock you flat. And didn't mind saying it.
We talked about the fact that it's essentially what it is. It's made from molasses.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about what exactly the process is like?
Well, certainly. Firstly, wherever you've got rum, you have to have sugar because it's a byproduct of sugar. And when you're refining sugar, the byproduct of that is molasses. Now, what they began to do with it, it was an experiment, of course, because when the colonists came to the New World, their supplies of beer and wine and the various other European things were very, very limited. So they experimented with all kinds, with fermenting and distilling all kinds of things, even pumpkin. That's why they had pumpkin beer, which is sort of unusual. But at any rate, what would happen after the sugar cane was harvested? They put it into rollers, which would crush the sugar cane stalks, and then they'd extract the juice. Well, once that was done, they'd boil it, they'd strain the juice through clarifiers, and they put it into copper pots. These are the famous pot stills you've heard of. They'd boil it on a flame and boil it and boil it from pot to pot to pot. And as they did this, there'd be fewer and fewer impurities. It would end up being refined. Now, once that happened, they'd leave it be for a while in a vat for it to cool. And from that, the sugar crystals would come. But there were troughs under the pot. There was a sort of siphon for the excess fluid to drip into. And what dripped out as the rest of it crystallized, that was the molasses. Mm-hmm. And then they would take the molasses, and they would put that through pot stills and refine it and refine it and refine it. Very like is done with brandy, with wine. And the result was rum. Fine molasses.
We have someone else to bring into conversation. Let's do that. Again, a caller in, I believe, in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I once looked up in, I think it was The Joy of Cooking, how to make hot buttered rum. And it said that it was that the Puritans described it as something that made you see double and feel single. And I just...
Could you say that again, please, ma'am?
That hot buttered rum made you see double and feel single.
Yeah. Very good.
And I don't know whether it's true that the Puritans like to drink this, especially in the cold weather, but if it is true, it adds another dimension to that group of people. Thanks. Just thought I would toss that in.
Thank you.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because the way they made hot buttered rum, not just in Puritan New England but throughout the colonies in those days, was kind of interesting in that they would take a vat and they would put in cold water, or tepid water, rum, honey, butter, all the other things. Then they would take a red hot poker and stick it in, and in a flash it would be ready. And apparently that made for some really, really, really potent potations. There was another side of the Puritans, you know, other than what we're used to thinking of. They were very repressive in a lot of ways. But then they would turn around and surprise you. That's very good. I'm going to have to remember it, though.
It's interesting when you consider the you know, if you had to name something that was an American spirit, or the American spirit, I'm talking in the alcoholic sense, I guess I imagine some people would think, well, that would be whiskey made from corn. It seems that maybe rum would challenge for the title, and perhaps would win.
Well, it certainly would, at least if you know your history. The fact is that in colonial days, rum was quite as big in the States as anywhere, and especially in New England. They obviously didn't grow sugarcane in New England, but what they did instead was import molasses. And they would ferment that and distill it and produce some very, very powerful rums. Medford rum from Medford, Mass. Had a really, really big, big, big reputation in those days. And, of course, the New England rum was the foundation of the famous triangle trade, which brought the slaves to America, without which, you know, without slavery, the southern half of the country and a good piece of the north wouldn't have been settled.
Yeah. Well, and it gets it, I suppose, if it has a dark side, it's this, and that may be one of the things that people remember from grade school in their early American history, the idea that that there was this triangle that slaves were taken from Africa to the West Indies to work raising the cane, the sugar plantation. Then their molasses were produced there. They were taken up to New England, and there they were distilled into rum, and they were taken back across the other way, back to Africa. And so that was the three corners of the triangle trade. And I suppose that some people would make this argument that perhaps a key there is this key connection between rum and slavery, that maybe without the one we might not have had the other.
Well, it would certainly seem so. The fact of the matter is that the kings of the West African coast who sold the slaves to the slavers became extremely fond of rum, to say the least, and would do almost anything to get it. Before that time, before the coming of rum, There was slavery, to be sure, both in Africa and over here, but there was nothing the Europeans had that the salesmen, if you will, wanted so badly as rum. Although it is interesting that the first Europeans to come to the west coast of Africa came for gold, which there were small amounts of. But it was really the opening of the tropical colonies in the New World that created the desire for slaves. You may remember Bartolomé Las Casas, the Spanish Dominican friar. Mm-hmm. He was very, very much concerned about how the Indians were dying off in huge numbers in Central America and the West Indies, because they really weren't suited as laborers. And he was the one who suggested that laborers be brought from Africa. I don't think he would have been too pleased with what happened with that idea. But nevertheless, that was the genesis of it. But without rum, it certainly would not have become the enormous institution it became. And without rum, an awful lot of things in all likelihood would never have happened. The cultural changes on the west coast of Africa itself that occurred wouldn't have happened. Because due to the supply of rum, due to the great taste for it that the locals developed, those kings who had a regular supply of it had more power in local politics than those who didn't. And that's where you see the consolidation of power on the West Coast by people like the King of Benin and so on. So, I mean, it's a very... Everything in history has consequences. Nothing just happens in a vacuum. Now, very often we're not aware of what those consequences are, but they're there. Another reason why the West African kings, for instance, were very keen on selling slaves to the Europeans was because their traditional markets in North Africa had been cut off by the Tuaregs. For many, many, many centuries, the slave trade had gone north. But when the Tuaregs besieged Timbuktu and cut the caravan routes, there were the kings of the West Coast with a lot of product, if you pardon the expression, and no place to sell it. Just then arrived the Europeans.
In this hour of Focus 580, our guest is Charles Colomb. He writes on a variety of topics, including religion and politics and economics and literature. He is the author of a newly published book, which is titled Rum, the Epic Story of the Drink That Conquered the World, and it's published by Citadel Press. And questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about the association that I'm sure would be in people's minds between rum and sailors, and that had a lot to do with the fact that rum traveled well. It was not so perishable, perhaps, as other spirits, so it would keep aboard ships for over long periods of time, and also that there was this daily ration of rum that was provided to sailors, even American sailors, at least up until around the Civil War when Lincoln stopped it. They also got a daily rum ration. So we have this association between rum and sailors, and certainly if there's anything that will be associated with rum in people's minds, it's pirates.
Absolutely.
And I don't know if that's because it has to do with the sea and rum being associated, or maybe the Caribbean and rum. Is there some particular reason other than those sorts of things that we do? When you think of rum, you think of pirates?
Well, I mean, it's an accurate thought. The fact is that rum is one of the major themes of the history of piracy in the 17th and 18th centuries. Part of it, for just the reasons you mentioned, A, the seagoing piece, because all the navies of the world, merchant and military alike, used the stuff. And, of course, sailors were sailors, you know, whether they were pirates or not. Secondly, operating primarily in the Caribbean and the Indian Ocean, the pirates of that era were constantly around the major supplies of rum, the major sources. But it had a very bad effect, shall we say, often enough, on pirate morale. You read stories, for instance, because there was very little discipline, oddly enough, amongst pirate crews. You read account after account of either of cruelty on the part of pirates, incredible atrocities, because they were all liquored up, or contrary wise, of incredible stupidities, leading to their defeat or capture or whatever, because they were too drunk to operate properly. So, and then, of course, their thirst for it was absolutely enormous. They'd do anything to get it. A good piece of Blackbeard the Pirate's downfall is said to have come from rum, in terms of his crews being fairly drunk when the Royal Navy sailed into Ocracoke Inlet. So, no, I mean, it's the association of the popular mind is absolutely correct. And, of course, you've got Robert Louis Stevenson with Yo-Ho-Ho and a bottle of rum and Treasure Island.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's talk with another caller here. Again, this is someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Another euphemism for being all liquored up is pickled. And it made me wonder, since preservation of food or almost anything else was an issue at the time, and we know about salting, salt curing, drying, any other number of ways of preserving things you need to take on long distances, did anyone at the time use that long strength of and long-lasting quality of rum to preserve or, in its own way, pickle any food or substance that they wanted to take for a long distance? I'll hang up and listen.
Absolutely. The preservative effects, and this incidentally goes back to something I touched on before. They did notice that you could preserve things in alcohol, and they used rum a lot for this. And that also reflected, it sounds a little primitive, but there you are, it reflected on the medicinal use of rum, because they saw its preservative effects and figured it would work as well inside as out. But yes, it was definitely used for it. A lot of our remaining Christmas dishes and things like that, jellied fruits and preserved fruits and all that, were originally done in rum, and some of them still are today. Probably the most grotesque example of the use of rum for this was after the Battle of New Orleans in 1815. The British general Pakenham had been killed in the battle, and after the British withdrew, they, of course, sailed back to England. Well, they kept Pakenham's body in a huge barrel of rum for taking him home, which was not uncommon in those days if they were going to bring someone back. Well, a group of sailors unwittingly tapped into that particular barrel and drank. They weren't happy.
Well, that reminds me, though, there's a similar story you also have in the book about Admiral Nelson, that
yeah.
After he was killed at Trafalgar, they put his body in a barrel of rum, and that there's apparently a story that the sailors actually, they heard about it, and they intentionally drank the rum, and from that time on, one of the nicknames for rum was Nelson's Blood.
Absolutely. You know, again, the sailors, like actors, tend to have a lot of superstitions. And I don't know for sure, but I would not be surprised if drinking the rum a naval hero was preserved in wasn't somehow considered considered to be a regular superstition as opposed to a one-time deal. But I have no proof of that.
So what is the origin of the term grog?
Grog comes from Admiral Vernon, who was the first one to really regularize the issue of rum and lay down rules for it and all that. You may remember him from General Washington, who served under him in the West Indies, the Siege of Cartagena, and it was to commemorate Vernon that he named his home Mount Vernon, just so you'll know. But one of Vernon's nicknames was Old Grogram. And he was called that because he wore a coat made out of a material called grogram. It was a sort of raincoat, a sea coat. At any rate, he was the one who decided that straight rum was bad for the sailors. So he ordered that it be cut with water and fruit juices and other things. And that resulting mixture came to be called grog. The rum would have its own effects. The water would keep it from being too overwhelming. And the fruit juices would fight off scurvy. That was his intention. But that mixed drink came to be called grog, and so it's been ever since, after Old Grogram. But oddly enough, in Australia, which in its early early history was very nautical, shall we say, being a maritime colony, grog became the word that the Aborigines there use for any kind of liquor. Because, of course, the first liquor they were introduced to was the mixed water, rum, fruit juice, grog of the Royal Navy.
We are coming into our last about 15 minutes in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest, Charles Coulomb, we're talking about rum and its history. He's authored a book on this titled Rum, the Epic Story of the Drink That Conquered the World, and it's published by Citadel Press. It would be out in the bookstores now if you're interested in the history or also in drinking it. There are some recipes for various beverages included in the book. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Among the many interesting things I learned that I think people will recall that there is an old-fashioned, I don't know if you can still buy it, but a rather old-fashioned men's cologne that's called Bay Rum.
Yes.
And Bay Rum, I don't know if it still does, but apparently Bay Rum actually did have rum in it.
That's correct. It's still made. It's from Bermuda. And, it was made with rum. I had a friend of mine. I don't know how I would say it, but this friend of mine was a non-drinker, and he came across some juniper berry cologne. Now, bay rum is made with rum. Juniper berry cologne is made with juniper, which is also used for gin.
Hmm.
And, of course, that distinctive smell you smell with gin is juniper berry. So he started using this juniper berry cologne and didn't understand why people were staring at him. Well, you won't get that from bay rum, but... That was my suggestion to him at the time. I said, look, if you want a booze-based cologne, go to Bay Rum.
Go to Bay Rum. Stay away from the juniper berry cologne.
It was very sad, though. And he never had a drink in his life. It was very unfortunate. But no, you said something earlier about whiskey versus rum in America.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I should make a point there, and that is that the Crown, in attempting to regulate the rum trade, at various points attempted to levy taxes on molasses and on rum. Well, the way that the New England farmers fought against that was to make whiskey. But they didn't make it out of corn. They made it out of rye. And up until the 1960s, the rye whiskey was probably the most popular whiskey in the United States.
Hmm.
Now it's very hard to find. But I love it myself, so I figured I'd make that plug.
Well, I know that there are people who really do favor it over that's made out of corn, and I have read that, and also the fact that there are still some rye whiskeys produced, but as you say, there aren't very many of them, and it's not easy to come by. It's easy to go out and buy a bottle of Jack Daniel's or Maker's Mark or something like that, things that are made out of corn. But rye whiskey is, as you say, some people say it's very fine and it's much better than that comes from corn. But it's not a terribly common thing anymore.
No, it's hard to find. So I always make a note of all the bars and restaurants here in L.A. that have it. But the other thing too is that another reason for corn whiskey's popularity was the growth of the frontier. The farmers that went out to places like Pennsylvania and Kentucky and so forth, beyond the Alleghenies, they didn't have any real means of preserving their corn for market. So the best they could do was to turn to whiskey and sell that. And you may recall that it was the attempt of the federal government to tax that whiskey, which led to the Great Whiskey Rebellion of 1798.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. That was corn whiskey they were fighting over.
Mm-hmm.
Rye whiskey was in origin more New England. It's interesting, too, that rye whiskey is still big in Canada.
Hmm. If they're talking about other associations with rum, I think probably, if there are other things besides piracy and the sea that people associate with rum, they think about Cuba. And certainly there are a lot of rum producers around the Caribbean, but there is a sort of a mystique about Cuban rum, and it may be like the mystique about Cuban cigars, that the mystique has to do with the fact that you can't get it, or that it's very difficult to get. But Cuba has been very famous for its rum for a long time. I mean, Bacardi was a Cuban rum. Is there something that's particularly special about the rum that's produced in Cuba?
Well, of course, it tastes a bit different from any other, but beyond that, it acquired a real mystique during Prohibition. During Prohibition, because Havana was pretty easy to get to, a lot of folk, anybody who could afford it really, would go to Havana to drink and to do the sorts of things they couldn't do back home. So rum became associated, Cuban rum, became associated with the high life, with everything that Havana became famous for. And, of course, when people would go back to New York or Boston or Cleveland or wherever they came from Havana, they would really, really want to, shall we say, keep the memory alive. And that sort of reintroduced rum to the United States because its popularity had fallen off here considerably after colonial days, being replaced to a great degree by whiskey and so on. But thanks to Prohibition and Cuba's presence off our shore, rum in general became popular, and especially Cuban rum, and it became associated with sophistication and freedom and everything else. The interesting thing, too, about Bacardi is that while they were founded in the 1880s in, when Cuba was Spanish, but it was Prohibition that really made them. And after Prohibition was over, they fought a case at law in the Supreme Court of New York. You see, they had a drink in Cuba called a Bacardi cocktail, which was had to be made with Bacardi rum. When the people I referred to, the American refugees, would go back home, they would order Bacardi cocktails, but of course, they'd have to take whatever rum the bootlegger could bring. So a Bacardi cocktail became just a rum drink, completely disassociated from the idea of the company. All right, Prohibition ends. Sanity returns to a degree. Well, there are Bacardi cocktails all over the place, not made with Bacardi. And the company get very upset. They take a bunch of people to court in New York, and they win. And the Supreme Court of the state of New York rules that a Bacardi cocktail can only be made with Bacardi rum. So all over the country, the Bacardi company have billboards put up. In California and Oregon and places that hadn't heard of rum. And that was really the beginning of a mass association around the country of rum and Cuba, Cuba and rum, Bacardi with Cuba, and so on. Interestingly enough, the if you ever travel overseas and witness, I'm sure you wouldn't actually drink any, but if you witnessed Cuban rum, it's usually bottled under the name Havana Club. When you see Havana Club rum, know that that is actually made in the original Bacardi distillery, which, of course, Castro seized. But the Bacardi family had already opened up distilleries before the Revolution in Puerto Rico and elsewhere. So when the Revolution came, they lost their home base, but they kept everything else. And, you know, they've gone on to become the biggest rum company in the world.
Mm-hmm. I was interested to learn the story of how it is the bat came to be on the label. And I think that there is somewhat for a long time I had this story that somehow there was association, this idea that there was some association between bats and the sugar cane. And in fact, it was just the fact that when they went into business, the Bacardis there in Cuba, in the place where the still had been set up, there were some bats living in the rafters. And I guess in Cuban folklore, bats are supposed to be good luck.
Right.
And so someone said, well, let's adopt the bat as the symbol of the product. And that's why it is that to this day, there is a bat on the label.
That's right. And it's also interesting that the Bacardi company are very big into conservation. And you'll be terribly shocked to learn that one of the species they do their best to conserve are bats.
Hmm.
Go figure.
We have a little bit of time left. And again, if folks listening have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Charles Coulombe, his book is Rum, the epic story of the drink that conquered the world. As we have talked, there is association, again, in people's minds between rum and the Caribbean. I was a little bit surprised to learn, though, just how widespread the drink is and production of the drink. There are rums produced in Australia. There's a rum produced in the Czech Republic. There's a rum produced in India. There's one produced in Nepal. I would never have thought of such a thing, although because the British were there, maybe that's why. Have you ever had Nepalese rum?
No, I'm afraid I haven't. There are a number of the more exotic types I've yet to try, though of course I hope to. But it is really a worldwide phenomenon. The wherever there was sugar, and a lot of places where there weren't, there's rum. It's an amazing drink, really, historically speaking. And as I say, one of the interesting things about it is that it's a taste that many, many, many cultures find very palatable. That isn't true of a lot of other drinks. A lot of Occidentals, for instance, don't care for sake. And certainly a lot of Chinese and Japanese really don't care for whiskey, although others would kill for it, to tell you the truth. They have a very, very big whiskey industry in Japan. But rum is something that almost everyone who came in contact with it was affected by. And one of the points I make in my book is that as sort of hybrid cultures, European and native, arose around the world, in Goa, in India, various places in Indonesia, Madagascar, the West Coast, the people of these cultures, like the Anglo-Indians in India or the Eurasians in Malaya, drinking rum also became a symbol of their connection to Europe. And it's a very, very important thing for them even today. Again, these are things that we don't really think about very much. But the penetration of Europeans around the globe has created a whole network of these sorts of hybrid cultures that are, A, terribly fascinating, and, B, have probably not gotten nearly the study they deserve.
Since the basic constituent or the precursor to rum is molasses, and I would think that, relatively speaking, the product would be the same no matter where that was produced. What really accounts for the differences? And I'm sure that people who are connoisseurs would say that there are important differences between rum, apart from the fact that some of them are light and some of them are dark, rums that are produced in different places. What really makes the difference?
Well, sir, any number of things. Some are kind of obvious because aging is involved. So there are differences for how long you're going to age it. What's added to it, the exact method of distillation, because there are several. The original pot still type is only one of three or four ways of producing it now. And again, they will say, the connoisseurs, will say that molasses from different places taste different.
Hmm.
The water that's added to the molasses is different. Basically, anything that makes any variety of liquor different from any other is at play with rum just as much. Many of the famous distilleries of the West Indies will boast about the spring that they're near and say that it's the water from the spring that makes the difference. Or the actual variety of sugar that's grown makes a difference. So the answer is there are tons of variables. And, you know, thank God for it.
Hmm. Do they all retain, or perhaps this is only true of the darker rums, a sort of a caramel quality that comes ultimately from what it is that it's made of?
That is true of the darker rums. But even your white rum, you could taste it. I myself am a fan of dark rums, to tell you the truth. And as you might guess, dark rums are dark because of impurities. All of the old rums, the earliest rums, were dark to amber. As distilling progressed, as they began to purify it more and more, you had white rums produced. Now, many of the dark rums are dark because of additives. They add things to white rum to make it dark. But a lot depends upon what it is they add. But no, I would say that you'd be hard-put to drink any rum that didn't remind you it comes from sugar.
Hmm. Is there a particular favorite that you have, something that would be good enough that you would say you would drink this neat like you would drink a single malt scotch?
Oh, sure. Quite a number. The Barbancourt in Haiti produce a couple that are like that. Mount Gay, I'm very fond of. And to tell you the truth, I'll drink Myers neat. It's again, I'm a dark rum fan.
Hmm.
But rum, the rums that you're likely to buy are almost always quite palatable neat. You've really got to go for some local brews to find something that'll rip your mouth up. You know, it's not like with whiskey where you give me a cheap scotch and I'll show you a real problem. You know, some of that stuff is really raw. But you'll be hard put to find a rum that isn't fairly smooth. But as I say, my personal favorites would be Barbancourt, Mount Gay, and Myers. I don't really care for some of the spiced and added to rums, although a lot of people do. But for me, they're the equivalent of wine coolers.
Well, I think we're about at the point where we have to round out the discussion. Again, to people who are listening, if you're interested in reading some about the history of this spirit, you should look for the book that we've mentioned. It's titled Rum, The Epic Story of the Drink That Conquered the World. It's published by the Citadel Press. It's out there now in books at bookstores by our guest, Charles Coulombe. And I haven't had a drink yet this morning, so I can't blame that. Thank you very much for spending some time with us this morning.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Today's program is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana for over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. The broadcast today also made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, featuring foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, cheeses, and gift baskets for the holidays. Party catering is also available. World Harvest Foods, located at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign. Tomorrow morning on the program, in the first part of the show, we'll be talking about the United States Supreme Court, talking a little bit about its past, present, and future. There has, of course, been lately a lot of speculation about the health of the Chief Justice, Mr. Rehnquist, and whether or not he would be leaving sometime soon. And I think there is the expectation that, a reasonable expectation, that sometime within the next few years, there will be some new members named to the court. We'll be talking about all of these issues a little bit tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour with David Garrow. He is Presidential Distinguished Professor of Law, currently on leave from Emory University. He'll be joining us by phone. Also in the second hour of the program, we'll be talking about the British humorist P.G. Wodehouse, and our guest for the show will be a British writer. His name is Robert McCrum. He's literary editor of The Observer and has a brand new book out, which is a biography of Wodehouse. We'll talk about that tomorrow morning in hour number two. We are here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions. Right now, we hope you'll stay tuned. Up next, The Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of The Afternoon Magazine, our guest will be University of Chicago Law Professor